Good morning.
All right, I want to pick up with just a kind of covering back over one or two things that we had to sort of speed through at the end of the class on Wednesday. And I want to then slow down and really try to take the story of Rehoboam and the snapshots that we have of his life and apply them to our goals. We'll take a few minutes to do that. And then kind of pick up and go through Abijam and Asa and Jehoshaphat today. And I don't know if we'll get all that way, but we'll get as far as we can. So we had to speed through this account at the end of what we have on Rehoboam, where he is invaded by King Shishak of Egypt. And the question was in here, why does God allow that to happen? Why does God allow the king of Egypt to invade Judah? And I'm sure there's multiple ways that we can answer that, but one of the key reasons we actually have is from 1 Kings, because this is a summary statement of Judah under King Rehoboam, where it says, Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy more than all that their fathers had done with the sins that they had committed. And it goes on, I'll reread this from what we read on Wednesday. It says, following this, they built for themselves high places, pillars, and sacred poles on every high hill and under every green tree. There were male temple prostitutes in the land. They committed all of the abominations of the nations that the Lord had driven out before the people of Israel. And so, under Rehoboam, you get sort of a reversion to idolatrous worship in the promised land. And all of the people, it says, on every hill and under every tree, there was some sort of object of devotion or worship to these other gods, and all kinds of abominable activity that are associated with those sorts of things. The writer of Chronicles just sums this up as Rehoboam had forsaken the Lord. And you get the prophet Shemaiah, whom Rehoboam listens to, right? Rehoboam listens to Shemaiah, but he does come to Rehoboam and he says, you have forsaken me. Thus says the Lord, you have forsaken me. So also, I have forsaken you to Shishak. And then it goes on then to describe the way that the Rehoboam responds to that in repentance. But Shemaiah still says at the conclusion of that they, that is the people of Judah, will become his slaves, Shishak's slaves, so that they may learn the difference. And this is the key phrase. And I had this occur Wednesday, we just didn't get to it. So that they may learn the difference between my service, that is the service of the Lord, and the service of the kingdoms of the nations. So this is a really important distinction that Shemaiah makes, that the Lord makes to Rehoboam, to say this is about learning the lesson of what the difference is between serving me and serving other gods. So one of the questions we might ask is, well, what is that difference, right? What is the difference between service of the Lord and the service of the kingdoms of the nations? What are your ideas or thoughts on that?
Well, probably the most obvious has something to do with those gold shields.
Yeah.
So the gold shields kind of represented prosperity. God blessing Solomon, God blessing the nation because of their dedication and their service, as far as them agreeing to this covenant that God would have, that he would be in their presence among them with his law, and that they would surrender their will to that. And so those shields, by them being taken, that's their prosperity. It's kind of, you know, their trophy to let them know, hey, I've been in covenant with the Lord. And now that those shields have been taken, you see that prosperity being taken, these blessings being taken away because they've forsaken the Lord.
Right. Yeah. So by serving the Lord, this is very much sort of the notion of the result of the covenant relationship, right? When you honor me, when you serve me, you will have prosperity. You will have the fulfillment of the promises. But when you don't, all of that prosperity, all of those blessings are taken away. And so one of the differences is the presence or absence of God's blessing and prosperity.
I think one of the obvious things, too, is that as slaves, they're oppressed.
Yeah.
To another king, whereas with God they have more freedom.
Yeah, I think it very much is about the independence and the freedom of the people and the nation, which is not to say that they were
free to do whatever they wanted.
Well, it's not as if they're sort of going back into bondage here, right? But certainly all of their wealth and productivity as a nation, to some degree now, goes in the service of some other people, right?
And we see even today where people think about serving God, following the Bible. It's so hard and so difficult to find out that the world is way worse when the majority of people don't do that. The oppression and the problems that crop up are way worse than the service that, and the restrictions you have to deal with.
Right. Done. Yeah. And that's a lesson that I think is sort of under the surface on a lot of these kings that we go through is this sort of radical anti-common sense thing that God says, if you actually just trust in me without having to go into what would normally, what all of the other kingdoms of the world think works, right? If you just stay here and devoted only to me, it's going to work, right? And over again, I think we see the kings of Judah, and certainly the kings of Israel this way, but in this, for the sake of this class, the kings of Judah, when they depart, right? When they say, oh, but it's got to work this way, that's where things kind of get into trouble. We'll see that even later on in this class with Asa and Jehoshaphat. All right, so that was really important. And then Danny brought up the sort of symbolic story of the shields of gold being replaced by the shields of bronze, sort of an indication of the downfall of Rehoboam's kingdom. So maybe we've talked through a couple of these things already broadly, but I thought we could take a minute and just think back through the whole of the story of Rehoboam, right? This is where the United Kingdom is divided, right? And it falls apart, it becomes two separate nations. So this is a good opportunity to sort of reflect on Rehoboam's story, especially in relationship to, I think, goals 2 and 3 that we've got. And Danny presented these originally in the introduction class. But let's talk about Rehoboam, and I'll sort of open it up as you sort of reflect on these. Let's talk about Rehoboam in terms of what characterizes effective leadership. What lessons can we learn from Rehoboam about that? And then also what it means for God to forsake, and explain how God's mercy and justice actually work in the context of both this forsaking, but also the broader context of keeping covenant with his people. What lessons can we learn from the stories of Rehoboam on either of those two things? You guys have any ideas on that?
I think the first one is listening to sound advice.
Yeah.
Rehoboam did not.
Right. So take us back through that.
Well, the people under Jeroboam came and asked him, your father's taxation is heavy. What are you going to do to lighten the load?
Mm-hmm.
And will you lighten the load? So he goes to the advisors of his dad, and they say, yes, do that, and they'll serve you forever.
Yeah.
But he didn't like that, so he turned to his own contemporaries, and they said, no, you make it harder on them. That's what he chose to do, because that's what he wanted to do.
Right.
And the people of Israel rebelled, and that's when he died.
Yeah. Wise counsel certainly is a quality of effective leadership.
And that ties in with pride. Just, we talked about how he did that because he wanted to be, bigger and better,
mm-hmm.
show his authority, whatever it is. Israel leads back to pride, wanting to be.
Right. Right.
It seems sure. like you didn't understand where Solomon's wonders came from. You know, Solomon, when he first started following God and asked for wisdom, that's where everything he had, right. he had came from. It looks like Rehoboam wanted to do some great things on his own, and he didn't right. understand where right. it came from.
And doesn't it seem like, just in terms of sort of an origin story of the person of Solomon versus the person of Rehoboam, there's such a dramatic contrast there of Solomon's request for wisdom and Rehoboam's he eschews wisdom for the sake of power, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So Rehoboam he actually had a great advantage because he was 41 years old when he took the throne, and Solomon had reigned 40 years. So he had spent his entire lifetime seeing his father reign. Mm-hmm. And perhaps maybe those early years, he saw some aspects of Solomon's good character, the character of his humility before God. But he also saw what Solomon became and how prosperity and success led to great pride, mm-hmm. pride that would be Solomon's downfall. And we see evidence of that pride in Rehoboam. But what we also see in the Chronicle account is that we see multiple times, actually twice, we see humility show up.
Yeah.
And this is where I think there is effective leadership, that even if pride is in me, that if I show humility in a circumstance, that good can come from that. And that's what we see with Rehoboam.
Right. Ultimately, the Chronicles account about Shishak and the invasion of that, really, that is told from the perspective in Chronicles of the way that Rehoboam avoids a worse disaster, yeah. right? His listening to Shemaiah is said to basically avoid the problem of, you know, he actually is going to take you back into bondage or something to that effect, right? So there are positive and negative things. Like almost all of these kings, we're going to go, at the end of it, we're going to say, okay, you know, we try to do, is he a good king or is he a bad king? And where, you know, the Book of Kings kind of gives us a definitive thing, there are some things about this where we go, well, which part, you know, which snapshot are you looking at? Kind of thing, right? So there are good and bad things to take away. What about that speaks to this notion of forsaking, right? Shemaiah says, when the Lord saw, you have forsaken me, right? This is, okay, thus says the Lord, you have forsaken me, so I also have forsaken you to Shishak. So, verse 6, the princes of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, the Lord is righteous. And when the Lord saw that they humbled themselves, the word of the Lord came to Shemaiah saying, they have humbled themselves, so I will not destroy them, but I will grant them some measure of deliverance, and my wrath will not be poured out on Jerusalem by means of Shishak. And so, what you see as this positive response to the prophets ultimately means that when God talks about forsaking, what does that mean? What does that mean that God forsakes Rehoboam? It's obviously in response to Rehoboam's actions, so it's a reciprocal thing. What does that mean?
Well, it means his presence is no longer with you. He left the temple because of the sins of the people.
Right.
He's not going to help you. He's not going to give you the things that he did because you're not following his rules.
Right. It's an acknowledgement that there is sin and evil that exists against God. It's been perpetrated against God.
Yeah. So I'll say this a little different than what Ken just said. God is there. And when we talk about the word trespass, going beyond a boundary. Mm-hmm. What we do when we forsake God is we go beyond the boundary of His grace, of His blessing of the covenant. We go beyond that.
Right.
When we do, we forsake all that is good within that covenant relationship.
Sure.
And so when we forsake God, what we're doing is we're denying ourselves the blessings that come from keeping that covenant. And so, yeah, it looks like God's forsaking us. The fact that we've lost that protection from our enemies around us. We see that with Jehoshaphat, that because of his faithfulness, God keeps the enemies at bay, that we would call that grace. And so what we do is when we go beyond that boundary, what we're saying is we forfeit the grace and blessings of God when we do that. And so what does it look like? God forsaking me.
Yeah, so then is it a matter of, I mean, you put that in terms of what does it look like, right? So, but is there any sense of an activity on God's part, right? Or is it just the absence of God's mercy and grace? So God is always merciful and gracious, and if we reject it, does God reject, or is there just sort of, this is a big theological question.
Sure.
Or is it just, well, then, you know, there's the absence of God's grace, and so it's not as if God is wrathful, it just looks that way to us, right?
Yeah, I heard Marty illustrate it this way one time. It's as if God is holding back the end of the world, the judgment, as if it's getting ready to just crush it any second, mm-hmm. but yet God holds that back. And when we go outside of that protection, we are, in essence, exposing ourselves to the very thing God is trying to protect us from.
Right. In either case, however you answer that question, what I think still is true, and this is important,
yes.
is God's grace and mercy never goes away, right? It's never absent, even within the language of forsaking, right? God's mercy is always there, and it's even expressed in the response to Rehoboam, because he and the other leaders of Judah listen to God's prophet.
The other thing that I think is that for the way of forsake is saying that says the to God, I don't believe you. Mm-hmm. It makes me I just reminded the scripture in John that says first John said that says that everyone that don't believe or acknowledge that Jesus is the Son of God, make him a liar.
A liar.
So I think in the whole context of the Old Testament and today, when we don't believe what God says in His Word, we are saying, I don't believe you. You're a liar.
Right.
So in that's why the God. Made commandments for all the kings of Israel and Judah that make a copy of his word so that he can read every day and he can fear me, that's mm-hmm. what he said. But all depends on the heart of these kings and also of our hearts.
Right.
So how much we really desire him to look for him.
Yeah.
Because we don't look for him, we forsake him.
Right.
We make him a liar.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for making that connection. Okay, so let's move on, and I think for the rest of the time we'll get as far through some of these other kings, and we'll go a little bit more rapid fire through these. So the successor to Rehoboam is Abijah, and the sort of key snapshot that we get for Abijah is this battle that takes place between he and Jeroboam. So, remember, Rehoboam had gathered the army. He was going to go into battle to sort of take back his portion of the nation. And then he listens to the prophet and he doesn't do that. But eventually, the battle gets fought. It just gets fought by his successor. And I find this story really entertaining just because Abijah's speech on the mountain at the battle is so, like, you read through it, and it feels like a sort of like when I was reading through it the first time, it actually sounds like one of those like monologues that like the bad guy in a superhero movie would write, like, this is why I've been so wronged that I'm going to take over the world and that kind of thing. But really, that speech is given to us in order to demonstrate the ways in which Judah had still, at least in the mind of Abijah, had not gone to the dramatic lengths of idolatry that even the northern kingdom had, right? So there's this battle that gets fought between Judah and Israel, and we're given the detail of the sizes of the army. Do you remember that? What's the difference in the sizes of the armies?
About half.
2 to 1.
Right, 2 to 1. 800,000 to 4. 800,000 to 400,000. So Abijah's forces are outmanned, right? But he stands up on the mountain, and he says to Jeroboam and to all Israel, he says, "Listen to me, Jeroboam. Do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt?" Anybody know what that means? A covenant of salt.
Preserves, I guess.
Yeah, there's a couple of other places in the Old Testament where that phrase is used. Probably the key one is, I didn't write it down, it's in Numbers, I think it's 18.
Mm-hmm. 18:19.
Yeah. And really, this seems to be just sort of a convenient expression for the notion of a preserved and elongated covenant, right? So the statement here is that this is a forever covenant, right? A covenant of salt is a forever covenant. we can kind of pick that up by the context too, right? He gave the kingship over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt. Yet Jeroboam. So this has to do with the different accusations that Abijah is making against the northern kingdom when he stands up and gives this speech. And there's a few things that he accuses them of. And one of them is to indict them on the manner in which they rebelled. Right? So Jeroboam, a servant of Solomon, son of David, and already in that phrase, right? You were loyal. You were a servant of Solomon. Rose up and rebelled against his Lord. And certain worthless scoundrels gathered around him and defied Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. Not just a servant of Solomon. Rehoboam's the son of Solomon. When Rehoboam was young and irresolute and could not withstand him. As if to say, you know, you took advantage of him, right? Again, this is a certain, you know, coming from a certain perspective here. But one of the things they say is, you know, you did Rehoboam dirty when you rebelled in the way that you did. But then, really, probably the biggest accusation comes following that. And now you think you can withstand the kingdom of the Lord in the hand of the sons of David because you are a great multitude and have with you the golden calves that Jeroboam made as gods for you, right? Jeroboam had set up the high places at Dan and Bethel and had established, had put up the golden calves for the people to worship. And so then he accuses them of this heinous idolatry. And on top of that, have you not driven out the priests of the Lord, the descendants of Aaron and the Levites, and made priests for yourselves like the peoples of other lands? And this is a funny comment in this. Whoever comes to be consecrated with a young bull or seven rams becomes a priest of what are not gods. So not only have you set up these false gods, but you drove out the actual God-ordained priests, and now you're just giving away priesthoods left and right, right? Anybody who comes with a bull, yeah, you can be your own priest, effectively. And we did read earlier in Chronicles about how because the priests and the Levites, the majority of them, had gone back to Judah and the cities of the Levites in Jerusalem, that the Jeroboam had raised up his sort of own group of priests. And so, these are the things that Abijah says and accuses Jeroboam of. What's interesting is, I'll back up on that. So, if we read this in conjunction with Kings, there's a little bit of a conflict here, right? Because this sounds like a pretty a stance that that a holy person would make against someone who's unholy. And yet, we know from Kings that all of this notion of the sacred poles and the ashram that are on every hill and under every green tree, well, that had continued under Abijah in even Judah. In 1 Kings 15 and verse 3, speaking of Abijah, he committed all the sins that his fathers did before him. His heart was not true to the Lord his God like the heart of his father David. We'll come back to that in a second. But while Abijah is sort of making this speech of, you're these terrible people who have done all of this heinous thing against the Lord, Abijah actually defends the practices of his own people. He says in 2 Chronicles 13, starting in verse 10, "As for us, the Lord is our God, and we have not forsaken him. And the sons of Aaron are ministering to the Lord as priests, and the Levites attend to their work. Every morning and evening they burn to the Lord burnt offerings and fragrant incense. And the showbread is set on the clean table, and the golden lampstand with its lamps is ready to light every evening. For we keep the charge of the Lord our God, but you have forsaken him. Now behold, God is with us at our head, and his priests with the signal trumpets to sound the alarm against you. O sons of Israel, do not fight against the Lord God of your fathers, for you will not succeed." So it's almost as if Abijah is saying, well, because we have the priests on our side, because we're doing things, the God-ordained way in terms of where we stand in our, cultic worship practices as opposed to the methods that you're using, that God is on our side and he's not on your side. And, he actually is right about that, as we'll see. Any problems or concerns with that stance?
It was sort of convenient speech.
Right, yeah.
We get thinking highly of themselves that they follow God, but right. Really they weren't.
Right, yeah. There's certainly some underlying problems. What's really sort of amusing about this story is what happens next. So what does Jeroboam do while this speech is going on?
Well, he's planning strategy.
Yeah.
And so he's going to outflank him by causing Judah to have to fight two fronts, which we know this is going to be absolute disaster for Judah. And so when I've read this, I've tried to give Abijah the benefit of the doubt that he's sincere. But I wonder if really what he represents is this this notion of national religion.
Yeah.
Like we would see in this country, we'd call it patriotic Christianity.
Yeah.
Somehow America is God's nation, and we tend to associate America with Christianity. And I'm wondering if perhaps that's something that's happening here with Abijah, because it is something convenient, even though he is speaking the truth about this. But the reaction that occurs as a result of this routing, when they realize we are going to be defeated, what do? They shout out to the Lord.
Yeah.
And this really, to me, is a beautiful story of God's mercy. Because even though God probably clearly sees through this lack of sincerity in Abijah as the leader of the people, and the lack of the people truly worshiping God because they had not removed the idolatry within their culture, that he goes ahead and spares them anyway.
So I think to a couple of things, right? To the first part of that, I think certainly, look, the nationalism is, to say it's part of the story here is to not do it justice, right? So, in our day and time, in Western culture, we have made a dramatic sort of break between the notions of church and state, right? That's a novel idea in the history of the world, right? For everything that you read in the Old Testament, and for all of the other, you know, nations and gods that existed in that time, like, the church always was the state, right? The state always was the church, right? Because gods were always tribal gods. That was part of the problem, I think, that God saw with it. So, of course, there's going to be this sort of, like, nationalistic sense, right? Because when I beat you in the battle, what that means is that my God is more powerful than your God. And vice versa. So, of course, that's the perspective that he's going to take. And then what happens with this is, yeah, so he's making this speech, and there's almost this sense that the way the story is told, that, oh, he's going to get, right, his sort of pride here, right? You almost expect this to turn out to be, you know, and God caused Israel to defeat Judah because of Abijam's pride. But that's not the way the story goes, right? The way the story goes is Jeroboam outsmarts Abijah, and Abijah wins anyway, right? Jeroboam sends half of his army onto the backside of the mountain, and now they've got him caught between two sides, right? And they're going to attack him from both ways. So he's outnumbered 2-1, and he's got him on both sides. And yet, Judah wins the battle, right? When Judah turned around, behold, they were attacked both front and rear. So they cried to the Lord, and the priests blew the trumpets. Then the men of Judah raised a war cry, and when the men of Judah raised the war cry, then it was that God routed Jeroboam, not Abijah. God routed Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah. When the sons of Israel fled before Judah, God gave them into their hand. And so this very much is a story about God siding with Abijah because of either the, you know, the limited sense of righteousness which they had, or at the very least, maybe as Danny indicated, this attitude of mercy towards God's people. These are the verses I just read.
Hey, Grant.
Yeah.
One of the other things is God is going to glorify His name.
Right.
And that was the message that Abijah presented. He did present the truth of God's word that mm-hmm. the sons, this is the covenant of salt.
Right.
And here you see God, so, you know, honoring that yeah. covenant.
Yeah. Through this. That's right.
Even though they weren't completely sincere or righteous in their own right. And isn't that a comfort to us?
Sure.
When we're not living the way we should, and yet God still is merciful.
Yeah, because God maintains His stance within the covenant, yeah. right? If we, as you mentioned earlier, if we do the trespass, right? If we go beyond, God still exists within the terms of the covenant, yeah. right? And He's always there, and that's His promised stance. We actually already read through. Of the writer of Kings assessment of Abijah's character and rule, because while he sort of defends the honor of the covenant, of God's covenant with the sons of David on this snapshot in the battle with Jeroboam, he still maintained, or still allowed to be maintained, these places of worship, of idolatrous worship in the land. Still in the account of the kings, you get the notion of God's commitment to David's line through the covenant, because it says Abijah committed all of the sins that his father did before him. His heart was not true to the Lord his God, like the heart of his father David. And then nevertheless, right? Actually, what that reads is nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the sight of the Lord. So there's this sense in the writer of the Kings that the successes that, to whatever extent Rehoboam had success and whatever extent Abijah had had success. It was for the sake of the covenant promises that God had made to David. And so God maintains, again, like we said, God maintains his stance in the covenant. How much time we've got? 10 or 15 minutes. Okay. So let's move through a couple of these other kings here. This morning we had readings for Asa and Jehoshaphat, and these might be the most chapters we've had to read. Maybe we will have to read for the rest of the class. Thankfully, a lot of the stuff, a lot of the detail that we get of Jehoshaphat, we can kind of skim over, because actually the majority of the bulk of the story of Jehoshaphat actually has more to do with the northern kingdom of Israel than the impact on the southern kingdom, but we'll come to that in a minute. Okay, so Asa. Asa actually is going to make some key reforms in the land to restore the people to their devotion and their soul devotion to Jehovah God, right? So what are some of the things that Asa did to reform Judah during his reign? And what's the result of that?
Well, he broke down the high places and took the pillars away and pretty much did everything except some of the worship at the high places.
Right, and really, all of that is either... It seems like there's like two or three phases to this, and Asa does sort of the first couple of phases, and then his son Jehoshaphat sort of completes the...
He also sent the priests and Levites, I think, out to... and commanded them to teach the people.
Yeah.
In all the cities.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a few things here. And the result of this is important. The commentary that we get on the result of these actions is important as well. He took away the foreign altars and the high places. He broke down the pillars. He hewed down the sacred poles of the Asherim and commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of their ancestors, and to keep the law and the commandments. And the kingdom had rest under him. He built fortified cities in Judah while the land had rest. He had no war in those years, for the Lord gave him peace. And this is interesting, right? So Rehoboam has to deal with Egypt. Abijah has to deal in battles with Israel. But under Asa has peace. And the writer of Chronicles attributes that to these reforms that he makes about getting rid of these other idolatrous practices in the land. And one of the sort of stories that we get, it's an example of this, is in 14, is that right? Actually it's about 9 through 50, and I've got a few of those verses up here. But to some extent, the peace that Asa has is demonstrated through this story in 2 Chronicles. So actually, Ken, can I get you to read 2 Chronicles 14, verses 9 through 15? This is the story of Asa up against the million-man armies from Ethiopia. Sorry?
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I know.
That's 9 through 14?
15. The end of the chapter.
Zerah the Ethiopian came out against them with an army of a million men and 300 chariots and came as far as Marsha. And Asa went out to meet him, and they drew up their lines of battle in the valley of Marsha. And Asa cried to the Lord, his God, O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against the multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Let not man prevail against us. So the Lord defeated the Ethiopian before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. Asa and the people who were with him pursued them as far as Gera, and the Ethiopians fell, and to none remained alive. For they were broken before the Lord and his army. The men of Judah carried away very much spoils. They attacked all the cities around Gera, for the fear of the Lord was upon them. They plundered all the cities, for there was much plunder in them. And they He struck down the tents of those who had livestock and carried away sheep and abundance and camels, and they returned to Jerusalem. So people were killed.
Yeah, and so one of the other details that we didn't read about is just before that it talks about how during this sort of time of peace, Asa was able to, he built the fortified cities and he raised up the army. His army was 300,000. It was a total of 580,000. 300 from Judah, 280 from Benjamin. But still, you know, at that, he's basically similarly about 2-1 outnumbered, right? And yet, because of the reforms that Asa makes and the peace that God gives him in order to raise up this army and be prepared for battle, that when it comes that he's attacked by this army, and with then the response to rely on God to bring them through the battle, he's able to do that. And so. You've got Asa who succeeds and prospers because of these reforms that he makes. But then after that, we have Asa being addressed by a new prophet that we read about, Prophet Azariah. And what is it that Azariah tells Asa? This is now at the beginning of chapter 15, 2 Chronicles 15.
He's basically reestablishing the covenant with Asa that he had made with his father David.
Well, so he's reminding him of a couple of things, right? He says, "Hear me, the Lord is with you while you are with him." As almost as to say, it's almost a statement of like, good job so far, right? If you seek him, he will be found by you. If you forsake him, he will forsake you. We've read that. We've taken that as sort of a calling card verse for the interactions between God and his people that we're going through in this study. But then after that, he reminds them of this. For a long time, Israel was without the true God and without a teaching priest and without the law. But when in their distress they turned to the Lord and saw him, he was found by them. But you take courage. Do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded. So he reminds them, this is what Israel used to be. You've started to sort of bring them out of it, right? Now, keep going. Don't let your hands be weak. Don't stop now. Keep going. Your work shall be rewarded. When Asa heard these words, he took courage. Right? Almost as, I mean, that's a way of saying he did what the prophet mandated that he do. He took courage. And he put away the abominable idols from all of the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the hill country of Ephraim. This is sort of phase two of the reform. He repaired the altar of the Lord that was in front of the vestibule of the house of the Lord. So he's going to make renovations to the temple. He gathered all Judah and Benjamin, and from those, from Ephraim and Manasseh and Simeon. So some of the, I don't know if you want to call them refugees, or those that had come back to Judah from the northern kingdom. And with all of those people gathered together, they entered into a covenant to seek the Lord, the God of their ancestors, with all of their heart and with all of their soul. And all Judah rejoiced over the word, over the oath, and the Lord was found by them. Again, note the way in which the writer sort of repeats phrases in the narrative in order to indicate that the words of the prophet were fulfilled and were obeyed. And so you've got these actions that Asa takes to restore and reform the people. I think also, yeah, one of the things that's not up here is at the end of chapter 15, along with the covenant, they make this whole big ceremony of these massive sacrifices, right? They enter into the covenant to seek the Lord. And then also one other thing is he removed his own mother from the position of queen mother because she had made a horrid image as of an Asherah. And Asa cut that down and crushed it and burned it in the brook Kidron. So, It also says, the high places were not removed from Israel in verse 17. That means the high places in the northern kingdom. That was a little bit confusing the first time I read it, as if, oh, he left something undone. What that means is they still stood in that northern part of the land that Jeroboam's sons were ruling over. He brought it into the house. And then verse 18. He brought into the house of God the dedicated things of his father and his own dedicated things, silver and gold and utensils. That's important for what we're going to read about next. And there was no more war until the 35th year of Asa's reign. So he's got this one big battle with Ethiopia. But basically, other than that, this is a time of peace in Israel. So it mentioned here that he brought some of these dedicated items of silver and gold in. But those are important because of the last piece of Asa's story that we read about. Asa is going to come back into conflict with Baasha, who is now the new king of the northern kingdom in Israel. And Asa is, you know, he wants to sort of get rid of this. So what does he do?
He makes an alliance with the Assyrians.
Right. And what does he use as sort of collateral for the alliance?
The gold and silver.
Yeah. All that stuff that he had just brought and dedicated back in.
Yeah.
Right? So Asa took the silver and the gold from the treasures of the house of the Lord and the king's house and sent them to King Ben-Hadad of Aram, or Syria, who resided in Damascus, saying, let there be an alliance between me and you, like that between my father and your father. I am sending you silver and gold. Go, break your alliance with King Baasha of Israel, so that he may withdraw from me. Almost, you know, paying off another country. Hey, you go attack them so they don't attack me anymore. And knowing that Aram and Syria are sort of a bigger, badder world power here, sort of using that to his advantage. And so there's this diplomatic action and activity to sort of get Israel off of his back. And as a result of that, the writer of Chronicles says that the prophet Hanani says, because you have relied on the king of Aram, I got it up. No, I don't have it. Because you have relied on the king of Aram and not have relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Aram has escaped out of your hand. Were not the Ethiopians an immense army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. For the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth, that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. You have acted foolishly in this. Indeed, from now on, you will surely have wars. Right, so this action, which was meant to sort of avoid conflict, is going to bring conflict onto Asa because he's now drawn into an allegiance with a foreign god. So we'll leave it here for today. On Wednesday, we'll pick up here. We'll go through Jehoshaphat, and then we'll take a look at Asa and Jehoshaphat together in light of some of our other goals and some of the themes of covenant that we can pull out from them at that point. So, okay. Thanks, everyone.